Alright, by process of elimination, I'm guessing you are Nico.
That's it.
There you go. Alright. This isn't even 1% of your final grade. So whatever you got on it, whether you are one of the people who got 10s or one of the people who get 0s, it's not the end of the world. Because you're going to have plenty more quizzes at some point in the near future. But everything I give you as far as quizzes, as it says on the syllabus, is something we covered the last class. So, in addition to getting the book, which more and more of you are in the process of doing it, maybe have already done so, reading chapters 1 and 2, and now we're starting chapter 3. So if you haven't gotten the book yet, you got lots of reading to do. And of course, just going over anything we went over the class before, so that way you can be prepared. This quiz was just that. But there was confusion in many of the answers. People focused on the civil trials, not the criminal. So I saw a lot of plaintiff versus defendant. I like seeing the plaintiff, but if it's a criminal case, no, it's not the plaintiff, it's the government, it's the state, it's the prosecution. Most people who got points at least said defendant. And of course, there was 5 things that I was looking for, and that's how I got 10 points. So, state or government versus defendant, and then the 3 potential outcomes. Fines, jail, confinement, detainment, something like that, and of course, the death penalty. I think 2 people got 10s, but most, if not everyone, got points. And at the end of the day, obviously, the more points you get, the better you'll do in the long run. But that was just the first crack at the bat. With emphasis on just the first crack. Close your notebooks, please. Shut your computers. I'm giving you another one. What? Wait, so shut your computer, shut your notes, both, do both. I am providing you with a copy. Do not flip it over until I say so. Oh, yeah. Don't do nothing. Do not do anything. I'm watching you. You don't want to get a 0. Or maybe you do. I don't know. Maybe one of those kind of things. All right. This quiz focuses on a good chunk of what we covered last class pertaining to venue. All right? I'm going to give you the instructions so that way when I say go and the clock starts ticking, you don't have to take time thinking, oh shit, what do I got to do? Because I will explain it. So one of the 5 criteria to sue is proper venue. We know both in the federal system and the state system, the bottom rung is trial court. That is the nugget, the heart of what I'm asking. I don't need to see appeals, I don't need to see the SJW, I don't need to see the SCOTUS. We're only interested in trials. So you need to remember how what I told you were the jurisdictions of the federal court system versus the state court system. And you will see 5 fact patterns in which you need to decide if you're an attorney, am I filing in state court or federal court? So at most, if your answer is state, 5 letters. At the minimum, if your answer is federal, you could put fed. Or federal, which is, you know, 4 more. So 7 letters. That's your response from each of the 5. State or federal. Got it?
Yes.
Are you ready? On your mark? Kiss it, go!
60 seconds!
Obviously, put your name on it.
I lost track of time. I guess you got 30 more seconds.
Shit, I hate it when I do that.
Damn.
Foiled my own plan. Ten seconds. Because I am lazy in sin, give your quiz to somebody else around you. If you get someone's quiz, yes, make sure they have their name on it. If not, give them a zero. And if they spelt their name wrong, give them a zero. If they don't know how to spell their name by now. All right. Does everyone have someone else's quiz? Write your name down on the bottom. Hurry up, do it quick. Write your name down on the bottom. You get an extra one right because I'm doing your quiz. All right, here we go.
What?
What?
Did we have to write why?
No. I just want to state a fact. All right, question. This is the thought process, and this is the easier one. What is the jurisdiction of federal courts? What is the subject matter that will get you into a federal court? Diversity of citizenship, that's one. What's the other one? Federal law, or U.S. Constitution, or U.S. Treaty, federal questions. That's it. So to get in the federal court, it must be something dealing with federal law or diversity of citizenship. And what is diversity of citizenship? People from different states, criminal or civil?
Either way.
No, it's not. It's civil. For what amount? $75,000 or more. So, these fact patterns, you're only going into federal court if there's a federal question or it's diversity, a civil case for $75,000 or more. So, what therefore ends up in state court? What ends up in state court? Make it simple.
State question.
Pretty much everything else. Okay? All right. So, let's look at number one. Pat wants to sue his next door neighbor, Dorothy, claiming that Dorothy promised to sell him the house next door. Is this a federal question or is it a state question?
State.
Does anyone know if you make a promise to sell somebody, what area of law is that?
State.
What?
Sales.
Sales deals with what?
Real estate.
Contracts. Real estate. Property. Guess what always court deals with property contracts?
Federal.
No.
State.
State. Always going to state.
So the answer to one is state. If it's right, give them a check. If it's wrong, put an X. All right. Number two. Paula, who lives in New York City, wants to sue Dizzy Movie Theaters, whose principal place of business is Dallas.
Ooh.
She claims that while she was in Texas on holiday, she was injured by the negligent maintenance of a stairway. She's claiming damages of $30,000. Where is she suing? Federal or state? Why state? Why not federal? Not over $75,000. Very good. Check or an X?
That was state.
That was state, yep. Two states. All right. Phil lives in Tennessee. He wants to sue Dick, who lives in Ohio. Phil claims that Dick agreed to sell him 3,000 acres of farmland in Ohio worth over $2 million. Why is this a federal? Parties of different states. It's a civil matter for over $75,000. All right. Pete, incarcerated in federal prison. By the way, how does one get into federal prison as opposed to a state penitentiary? Yeah, probably committed a federal crime, right? All right, just subtle hint there. All right, and he wants to sue the United States government. Is that the federal government or is that a state government? Okay, I'm leading you. See what I'm doing? I'm leading you here. He claims that his treatment by prison authorities, by the way, if you work in a federal prison, are you a federal employee or are you a state employee? Okay. Violates three federal statutes. Did I say it enough?
No.
Is this a state claim?
Thank you. It's a federal claim. Very good.
All right. Last but not least, Pedro takes his car to Tim's garage for new tires. During the installation, one of Tim's employees inadvertently nicks one of the brake lines, resulting in a soft spot of the line that explodes the first time Pedro applies his brakes. Pedro, unable to stop at an intersection, runs a red light, slams into 87-year-old Gertrude, killing her instantly as she crosses the street. Is this a state issue or a federal issue? State. Poor Gertrude. All right, give them back to the person who you took them from. Person who had it, take a look at it, make sure your name is spelled correctly, and then pass them forward.
I like that tie a lot.
Oh yeah.
That's a nice tie.
Yep. You'll never see me wearing the same tie twice.
We gotta put a grain on. Right. I'm dead, yeah.
Thank you. I was going to say, you want to get a grade? Yeah, there you go. You can't get points if I don't get your quiz back. No, it's not fucked up. It's legitimate.
No, no. I'm talking about a six.
Ah. All right. So, by the way, the alternative to the first quiz, which was, you know, who sues who in a civil case, and what's at stake, guess what we're going to do today? We're going to do civil. Because, by the way, the vast majority of cases that go to court are, in fact, civil claims. And as we go through it, we are also going to cover all of the precise verbiage that you are going to need to know for the exam. And once you understand those terms, when I give you your first cases to brief, you'll be like, okay, I know what they're talking about. Civil litigation. Now, FYI, there is, to some degree, obviously, differences between the civil process and the criminal process. I don't really want to focus on the criminal yet, but there are some points that I'm going to insert criminal references because of the differences.
So obviously, one of the biggest differences is right out of the gates is who the parties are. If it's a civil case, who is suing who?
I'm suing Jose.
What?
I'm suing Jose.
Yeah, but what is your official title?
Plaintiff.
You are the plaintiff. You're the person bringing the claim. And if it is a criminal case, who is bringing the claim? The government. Okay, the state. The prosecution.
Somebody.
All right. Obviously, the person being sued in both instances is referred to as the defendant. Why? Yeah, they're defending themselves. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's as easy as that. It's as easy as that. Now, FYI, in your readings, you may see reference to claimant. Claimant is the same as plaintiff. Claimant is the technical phrase for the person bringing the claim. But once everything gets filed and it begins going through the process, claimant is referred to as plaintiff. Again, it's only just because you may see it, and I just want you to be familiar. All right. Now, in a civil case, there are different stages. And the first significant stage is referred to as the pleading stage. The pleading stage. Does anybody know what pleading refers to? Hold on. You're stating your case. You're making your plea. And you're also pleading with the court to take up your case. And it generally refers to the legal claims, any defenses, or any issues involved. Basically, what you're doing is you're laying everything out. Now, by the way, pleadings also serve as the framework for the actual case, the trial. Because here's the funny thing. Litigation involves a dispute. What happens if there are facts that are not in dispute? Do you need to plead that? No. So, for instance, if I was to sue Reed, and in my filings, I described him perfectly by his name, by his address, and he responded, yes, I don't need to prove that anymore. That's not a subject matter for the trial. The only parts of a trial are those facts that are in dispute. So, is his name Reed? Yes. Did he throw me down a flight of stairs? Well, he's claiming no. There's the dispute. That's what is argued in court.
Now, the pleading stage begins with the filing of a complaint. And by the way, I'm pretty sure on my website, in some of the documents, I'm pretty sure I put a copy of a federal complaint and a state of Massachusetts complaint in there, just as a reference, just so you can take a look at it with your own eyes.
But what a complaint is the document that is filled out
with all of the basic facts involved in the claim.
Typically, it is short, concise, and it involves a statement of why you're there. So, FYI,
I was sued not long ago by a contractor claiming that I did not pay him what I promised to pay. Factually, he was correct. So in his claim, what he put down was Lemanic did not pay me $5,000. And he was asking the court to take from my wallet $5,000 to compensate him for his alleged losses. That is the nugget of a complaint. You don't deal with the facts, you don't deal with all the circumstances, you don't deal with all the explanations. You didn't pay me, please give me money. Well, once he filed, a letter arrived in my mailbox, certified letter, that had a copy of his complaint. So I could see what he was suing me over. And there also was another document in there. A demand that I appear. Summons. That I show up at the court at a particular date and a particular time. Now, if it's a criminal matter, criminal summons will typically be delivered by the sheriff. And they will keep looking for you until they can physically put it in your hand. But this was a small claims summons, so it was mailed. And my signature acknowledging I received the letter was enough. Now here's the catch. The moment I had that in my hand, I had 30 days to file what is technically known as an answer.
Is it always 30 days?
Yes. Sorry, wrong. 20 days. Taking a federal court. State is 20. State is 20. We'll focus on state law. Now, what is the answer? Well, the answer is my reply to my contractors, my former contractors' complaint. And it contains a bunch of yeses and nos and room for me to give a more detailed response. Did I have a contract with said contractor? I put yes. Did the contract involve construction of my garage? I said yes. Did I fail to pay him that $5,000? I said yes. And then guess what I did? Being the lawyer that I am, I provided my legal defense. Under Massachusetts law, final payment is not due until the customer is fully satisfied. I was not fully satisfied because you know what Massachusetts law also requires all contractors to provide? A full materials list and any relevant warranties from the manufacturers. And guess what he did not give me? Either. Oh. 100%. So, if you reply to a fact that looks bad, what I am doing is I'm giving my defense and justifying my actions. Did I do a wrong? Yes. Is he entitled to compensation? Yes. But is he really? And unfortunately for said contractor, the answer is no. So, if I did not reply, the contractor could have gone to the court after that 20-day period expired and put in a request for what's known as a default judgment. A default judgment. A default judgment is an automatic 100% win for the party who receives it. So if I did not reply, contractor would have gotten basically a demand from the court that I fork up $5,000. And if I did not pay him within whatever time that was in the judgment, I would have been held in contempt of court and I could have gone to jail. But unfortunately for the contractor, I did reply. Now here's the funny thing. He tried getting his attorney to send demand letters to me, all of which I replied. And I laid out exactly what I put in my answer. So guess what was part of the evidence that I was prepared to show the judge magistrate? All of the emails. I made my best effort, as is allowed as a homeowner, as a customer, to get what I am entitled under the law. He did not comply. Now the funny thing is he went and filed it about 6 months after I responded to the lawyer. Because I replied naively a couple of times, but then in my final reply, I put my law office logo on there, and I signed my name, Jesse Lemanic Esquire, attorney at law. That kind of made his lawyer probably say, oh shit. But he must not have gotten good legal advice, so he filed. Which you are entitled to do. Now here's the funny thing. In the end, I ended up receiving a default judgment. Why? Well, on the day that I was supposed to appear, I showed up. I had my set. I had pictures. I had documents. I had everything. Because like I told you last class or maybe the class before, if you're going in the courtroom, you are prepared to destroy your adversary. Well, guess who didn't show up? So guess who got an automatic win? So guess where that $5,000 is today? I think I went out and bought Tesla stock or something.
Oh, shit. Well, that's not good.
What are you talking about? This was like 4 years ago, back when it was like 100. It's now like 500.
Yeah, you're right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
it was 4 years ago, and it's good.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. The rules of procedure are precise, but they have consequences. And if you don't follow the rules, you don't deserve to win. So he lost. Dumbass. By the way, in small claims court, which if I do go to court, that's usually what I do. I help people out. I am batting 100%. Never lost. All right. There are other pleadings that can be made when you're doing the filing, in addition to the complaint and the answer. And this is where, when some of you said, well, what if, and I said, we'll get to it. This is where we're talking about. So let's say plaintiff sues defendant, but defendant, once he gets the complaint, decides to turn around and sue the contractor, which I did contemplate doing. Why? Well, because I had been responding and he was unresponsive. And I thought about suing him to force him to produce what I was looking for. And then I turned around and said, what the hell am I going to do with like 500 pages of receipts and all of the warranties, because I do know, after all, what product was put into my garage. I'm not dumb. So if there ever was an issue, I could figure out who the manufacturer was. But I didn't care.
If you were to end up having someone ever or whatever, and him there providing that list, would you then be obligated to pay him?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So then you're not.
So the job of a court is to settle the dispute in a way that allows potentially both parties to get justice. So what would be just? Well, if I turned around and I sued him demanding that and he produced it, yes, I would be fully obligated to pay him. But guess what? I didn't want to pay him. So guess what I did not put a demand in for? I was just proving that he was wrong. Because it would have taken a lot of effort. Because do you think the contractor kept every single receipt? Because literally I was requesting, I wanted a total count of nails that were put in all of the boards. I wanted a full inventory of all of the lumber. I spelled it all out.
So he still didn't end up providing the list?
No.
Well,
the question was the $5,000 really worth it to him? Because you know how many, what he would have had to do? Yeah, he probably should have, but he didn't. So yeah, he didn't want to have to go back and figure out every last thing that was ordered and reproduce everything.
It's really cliche when you mean, like, somebody requests information from another to figure out your son, and they show up the box, and the box.
Yes. Yes, sometimes that does happen. Because the opposite can happen as well. If he actually had all that stuff, he could have just dumped it all out of the table. There you go. But I was betting that he didn't keep good records. And obviously I was right. It was a gamble and I won. All right, so counterclaim. Initial claim, plaintiff sues defendant. Counterclaim, defendant sues plaintiff. What happens if plaintiff sues defendant, but defendant was not 100% liable? Because someone else was also involved. Well, that's known as a third party complaint. And I'll give you a visual. So let's say plaintiff sues defendant. So we'll go back to that last question on the quiz. The brake job. And dead grandma. Well, Gertrude's family decides to sue, I think it was Pedro who was driving. Pedro would be the defendant. What is he being sued for? Well, civilly, you could be sued for wrongful death. Well, Pedro's like, was I driving the car? Yes. Did I hit grandma? Yes. But. It's not my fault. I only hit grandma because I had the brakes. So what Pedro would do is he would turn around and bring in garage. Because maybe plaintiff, when they filed, didn't know that the reason why grandma got hit was because he got a bad brake job. So defendant would bring in defendant number two. And then once named, plaintiff effectively would be suing both. And what the jury would decide, if there's a jury, ultimately is the percent of liability. So can Pedro turn around and say, I wasn't driving the car and I didn't hit Gertrude? No, he can't. So he is at least partially at fault, because why didn't, once he realized he had no brakes, he tried, you know, going into a building or something like that, or hitting a parked vehicle. No, he chose to keep going forward and he hit the grandma. But why were the brakes, or why was did the car fail? Well, that's the company. So maybe they're 80%.
Would it just be a criminal
case? No. Not this particular, because plaintiff decides to sue for wrongful death. If the government got involved and they pursued Pedro for vehicular homicide, that would be a criminal case. But those aren't the facts as I discussed them. By the way, I'm glad Mike asked me that question, because let's remember it this way, right? If you have an incident, it could be both. It could be both a criminal and a civil. Just like if it's a criminal, it could also be a federal or a state. How's that for confusing? What incident? You got federal charges, you got state charges, plus the family suing. It's possible.
It's possible.
But for our purposes in class, it's very, very important that we kind of watch the bouncing ball. Don't assume, just read what I give you.
All right. Here's an interesting situation. Cross-claim.
What happens if, we'll keep it the same fact pattern, Gertrude's family sues Pedro, who brings in the defendant, the garage. Well, what happens if garage decides to counter-sue Pedro? Because maybe the garage told him you shouldn't apply the brakes fully, suddenly, at least for a week. So that way the pads wear in. Well, D2 could essentially do a cross claim against D1. And what would be the outcome? Well, if the jury found the garage 80% liable, guess what the garage is suing Pedro for? To pay that 80%. Now, am I going to put a fact pattern on you that gets this complicated? Hell no. But when you read some of the cases, this is what you're going to see. Because at the end of the day, if you're being sued, do you want to pay? Or are you going to try to put people in front of you that maybe have deeper pockets and make them pay?
All right, questions?
No questions?
All right.
Well, once the court figures out who's involved, what are the claims? And what are the defenses?
It goes to the next stage. Discovery. Discovery is the stage in which... Oops, sorry.
The discovery stage is the point in the trial where both sides try to discover evidence to support their claims. Basically, to win, you can't win just because you feel like it. You can't win because you think so. No, the only way you can win in a trial is if you can prove with evidence your claim. And if you are being sued, you need to gather evidence to support your defense. In my civil case against the contractor, one of the pieces of evidence that I prepared and I was going to present, had we had our hearing, was a printout of the actual statute found in Mass General Law. So I took the time and I looked it up. Although, truth be told, I did that when the lawyer first contacted me. But you know what I also did? I added into my response that I was not satisfied with extra areas of work. And I went around and I took a whole bunch of pictures. I took pictures of plywood with it already starting to pull apart. I put in one 2x4 that I found, because it was an open garage, I didn't enclose it, that had cracked, you know, so I took lots of pictures. I went down to CVS and I printed them out, a nice stack of colored, you know, glossy 4x6 pictures to show to the judge or the clerk. But that occurs during the discovery stage. Now, if he was smart, he would have gone out and gotten all those receipts. And he would have prepared all those warrant deeds and present them in court. Because if he would have done that, I would have lost. But he did not. Now, of course, there are rules for everything. And your book does refer to, in chapter 3, I believe, the formal tome, commonly referred to as rules of civil procedure. These are the devices, the methods, the items that are allowed as evidence in your claim. I'm going to give you the major ones. Why, again, you're going to see these items in some of the cases that I'm going to have you read. The first common form of production, producing evidence, are known as interrogatories.
Interrogatories.
Interrogatories are written questions. Written questions that are given typically to the parties that are being sued. But you could also give them to witnesses as well. These are to be answered, signed, dated, in return. If you've ever watched a courtroom drama where one of the lawyers brings the witnesses up to the stand and begins asking them a series of questions to which the witness is supposed to answer yes or no, believe it or not, that witness has already been asked those questions. And if it's a small, minor case, the lawyer actually has the written response to the questions in front of him. So in a real trial, not on TV, the lawyer will, before the judge and the jury, say, okay, witness X, in the interrogatory that you signed, dated September 22nd, you answered to the following. This statement, is that true? Yes or no? Yes. Is this true? Yes. Did you say this? Yes. Because, by the way, what happens to that witness if they contradict that written statement? Well, if on the document you signed you said, yes, I was at the ice cream shop, but then you're up on the stand, and suddenly you turn around and say, no, I was not, the lawyer's going to be, well, why in the interrogatory did you say you were? And the jury is going to sit back and they're going to go, oh, that witness is not credible. He's lying. Which ultimately is going to hurt that person's position. Questions on interrogatories. Now there's another form of the same process, and that's known as a deposition. Whereas an interrogatory is a written response to a series of questions, a deposition is kind of like a mini hearing in which the witness or the defendant or the plaintiff is called into an office. The court will provide a stenographer to make a transcript, and under oath, the attorney for the other side will ask questions. And just like the example I gave with the interrogatories, the same thing will happen in the courtroom. Were you at the ice cream shop? No. Then why did you state you were during deposition? By the way, depositions are also taken by parties who are witness to the event. So, like, say for instance, you're suing a hospital claiming medical malpractice. Well, the nurses who were on duty that night could get called into deposition. The treating physician could get called in for deposition. If you're suing and you demand from the other side tax records from the business to basically prove that they're capable of financially paying you what it is you're claiming. Because, by the way, if you go to a local mom and pop, you know, like corner variety market, and you try suing them for $10 billion, one of their defenses is going to be, well, you don't have that money. Well, what happens if you think you do? Well, you can actually demand they produce tax records. And then once provided, you could bring in their accountant and depose them. Did you prepare these documents? You know, is there any, you know, suspected fraud or something along those lines? Anybody that you want to testify, either on your behalf or you know the other side is going to have testified, you can bring them in and depose them. Interrogatories and depositions deal with people. What happens if you want stuff? Well, to get physical items, you would put a motion in or request to the judge for what's known as production. Production are written requests for either documents or other types of tangible evidence to help you prove your case. Now, here's the catch. If you have evidence and you are the defendant, you do not have to produce the evidence, especially if it makes you look liable. But if the plaintiff puts in a request, you must. Bless you. So, case in point, let's say you go in a convenience store and you slip and fall. You decide to sue the convenience store for negligence. But guess what you forget to ask? What would be the easiest way to prove your case? Video footage. But you forget to ask for it. Does defendant have to produce it? Nope, not at all. You don't have to produce evidence unless requested. But if the court grants that motion, and you get that request, you better produce it. Because what do you think is going to happen during the trial if, when asked, oh, we requested video footage and they didn't produce it? What do you think the judge is going to do? Why did you not? And if you turn around and say, oh, something happened to the file and it just was no doubt, that's going to make you look bad. Because when the jury makes the decision, I hate to say it, juries can be your best friend if you're in trial or your worst enemy. But juries ultimately respond on emotion. And if they feel you're being slimy, then chances are you're going to lose. Because there's nothing in the law that says the jury has to like you. You also have the right to produce not just regular witnesses, people who were there, who may have seen, may know something, but you can also bring in expert witnesses to help build a circumstantial pile of evidence to support your claim. So, think of, I don't know, a situation where you're suing the town because you're claiming that the town didn't properly, you know, treat the roads, and they knew that there was a low point in the road that always, every single time it got cold, gathered ice, and they never did anything about it. So you're driving along and you hit that ice and you smashed into someone's house. Well, you may want to pull in a weatherman. Was it cold enough to have ice that day? And the weatherman will say, yeah, well, according to our data that we reported on that day, you know, it was 48 degrees. Then what's going to happen to your claim?
But here's the funny thing about these so-called experts.
Most of them will testify for pay. So you can get, like, medical specialists. You can get, you know, crime scene specialists. You can get engineers. But for every specialist expert witness you get, guess what the other side's going to do? They're going to get one that's going to say the exact opposite. No, it was really not 48 degrees. According to my data, it was actually 22 degrees. And then what happens? Well, again, it goes back to the jury. Which one do they feel is telling the truth? All right. Now, here's the funny thing. Just like if you don't answer, you can end the case. If, during the discovery stage, it looks like you have so much evidence, and you're the defendant, that supports your defense, you can actually file a request during discovery that the case is dismissed.
And if the judge, after reviewing your stacks and stacks and stacks of evidence, believes it,
they're not going to waste the court's time. They're not going to waste the court's money. They're not going to waste time of a potential jury pool. They will grant the motion and then the case is done. Plaintiff loses.
Once the motion to dismiss is filed, does that extend the litigation timeline?
The timeline is ultimately determined by the filings. So, when you put your claim in, the judge will basically say, again, depending upon the complexity, you know, you have 6 months for discovery. But say you're 3 months in, and you have truckloads and truckloads and truckloads, basically showing plaintiff is lying, has no basis for a claim. Well, the judge isn't going to go that full time. They can cut it short and end it.
Is there a way that the timing when you can file the motion?
No, because you lose your ability to file a motion to dismiss the day trial starts.
So if you file it like the day before trial starts, does that stall the trial?
No, because the judge will, let me be more precise. It depends. If you go in there with a truckload of stuff and the judge is able to get through it quickly, then it may be that day. But the judge may continue to give the court a chance to review what you're presenting.
But I'll tell you one thing. If you are a defendant and you're going to push for a motion to dismiss, you don't wait to the last minute. You want it to be done. You file it as soon as humanly possible.
I was thinking, if you know that you would lose a trial, you still have tons of evidence in your file,
the judge will not be happy if you can't substantially prove you have at least enough to potentially be considered for this motion.
So you can't say, Your Honor, I have a whole bunch of evidence, I'll get it to you in 3 months. It doesn't work that way. You have to be able to produce on the spot. Other questions? Now, by the way, you know what could also be grounds for a motion to dismiss?
What happens if plaintiff didn't file a proper claim? You know, you breached the contract, but he sued you for negligence. They're different areas of law. Wrong claim. You could turn around and say, Your Honor, there is no breach of contract here. If the judge reviews it, it's dismissed.
What happens if it's the wrong venue?
Motion to dismiss.
I referred it to a lawyer, and a lawyer filed the paperwork wrong and got the auto dismissal because of, like, wrong venue or something. I didn't sue my lawyer to put it off into something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Carol, you put your hand up?
Yeah, so a motion to dismiss, is that going from the defendant?
Typically, yes.
Okay.
Typically, yes, because when we get to trial, there's another mechanism that the plaintiff could. Because, Carol, if you think about it, why would the plaintiff want to end the case? If you have so much evidence that you know you're going to win, you want to get into the courtroom on day one.
Now, when would a plaintiff potentially file a motion to dismiss?
What happens if all the evidence that gathered, the plaintiff suddenly realized, oh my God, I'm actually potentially liable for something else? In that case, the plaintiff will want to say, sorry, Your Honor, my bad.
Other questions?
All right. Well, once the discovery period ends, all of the evidence is gathered, all of the documents are produced, all of the witnesses have been deposed,
then at some point on the calendar, you're actually going to have to show up to court. Now, of course, as I've told you, if there is no judge, it's referred to as a bench trial. But to make it simple, we're going to include a jury.
The judge, as I said, I believe last class, is the trier of law.
The job of the judge is to make sure all of the rules of procedure are followed. Jury is the trier of fact. Trier of fact. Yes?
Question? Dan is hurt.
Basically, the jury hears all the evidence and is going to make a determination.
Because this is a civil trial, if defendant loses, what is the court going to hold the defendant as being?
Liable.
Liable. Now, you've seen enough courtroom dramas to know how it begins.
Trial commences when both attorneys, the attorneys for both sides, stand up before the judge and the jury and make broad opening statements. If it's the plaintiff's attorney, and by the way, the plaintiff always goes first,
it is generally brief. If you are suing somebody, you don't want your attorney to get up in soapbox. You want them to be short and sweet. Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we're here to essentially prove that defendant Joe Blow wrongfully caused harm to my plaintiff, Amy Smith, and thus we are asking you to provide compensation, so that way Miss Smith can be healed of all the harm she suffered at the hands
of the defendant. And then guess what the defense attorney's gonna do?
No, sir, everything they said was wrong. No, they'll basically say the exact opposite. Your Honor, ladies and judge, jury, thank you for taking the time to be with us here today. It is our hope that after we are able to provide you ample evidence, you'll show that there is in fact no liability, you know, for my client. And we hope you side with us and basically bring an end to this case in our favor.
Good opening statements, 15-20 minutes, no more.
Because the last thing you want is the jury to sit back and get that effect that you get when you're in my class at about this point in the class, when you just start hearing blah, 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 blah.
Short, sweet, concise. Then,
the trial begins. Plaintiff goes first, provides evidence,
witnesses, testimony, production of physical items, pictures, anything necessary for them to prove their claim.
Now here's the catch. There's a very important standard that the judge enforces as they're presiding over the trial.
Relevancy. Is the evidence relevant to the claim? You are making a claim, you are Gertrude's family, that Pedro hit Gertrude. Well, what happens if Pedro's lawyer gets up and wants to call to the stand Pedro's third grade teacher? Because when he was in third grade, now he's about 50, he was such a sweet boy who used to bring in apples for the teacher every single day. And he would always help bash out the chalk erasers. He was just a good boy. Is that relevant to the case? No, so the judge would not allow the third grade teacher to take the stand. Because it has nothing to do with why they're there. Why? Again, it goes back to time and money. Time and money. The judge is operating on the taxpayer's money. And the judge will only allow enough time so that way justice is achieved. Now, in terms of evidence, there's two types. There's direct evidence. Direct evidence are examples of evidence that prove facts, essentially. Proves the existence of a fact. So, like, a photo of the intersection, the moment the car hit the woman. That would be a direct piece of evidence. Because it's showing you the exact incident. Video recording. Testimony for a witness that was there and saw it all play out. That is all direct evidence. Because you are presenting evidence about the incident. But there's also circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence indirectly establishes evidence presented as direct. So, for example, the accident takes place on Main Street at 6:15 p.m. Well, you find a witness that saw Pedro's car turning onto Main Street at 6:10. Well, obviously you want to be able to prove that Pedro's car was actually on Main Street. Well, maybe you don't have anyone that saw the car on Main Street. But you have someone that saw it turning on. That's enough. That would be circumstantial. Or if, say, you're trying to prove that it was actually Gertrude that was there in the intersection at 6:15. Well, you're going to bring in some witness that saw her in the grocery store checking out at 6:03. Again, why? You're trying to prove that she was actually in the air. Another circumstantial piece of evidence would be something like fingerprints. You know, just because you're at a scene and fingerprints are found, that doesn't mean that that particular moment when you put your hand on something, that was involved in whatever the claim is. But if there are fingerprints on site, that kind of hints that maybe it could have happened. Questions on that? Now, FYI, there is references in some of the cases, as well as your book, to what's known as hearsay. Does anyone know what hearsay is?
It it's not fact or it can't be proven?
Yes, it's something that can't be proven. Hearsay refers to spoken words. It's an out-of-court statement. It's an out-of-court statement that a witness may have heard. So, let's say I am outside. And Andrew hears me scream. Fucking birds. Shat on my truck. Well, here's the thing. Andrew could testify to that. Because he heard me say it. But Andrew, 15 minutes later, goes and tells Joe down in the cafeteria, hey, you're never going to believe what LeManic said. But Joe is called to the stand and he says, oh, I heard from Andrew that LeManic said. That's hearsay. Because can Joe actually substantiate whether or not I said it? Or is Andrew, does he have an axe to grind because he probably got like a 1 on this quiz today? He's mad at it. The court is aimed in establishing facts, not opinion. And by the way, if hearsay gets admitted, that could be grounds for an appeal. Because that's a violation of the rules of procedure. So what happens is if Joe was to take the stand and said, oh yeah, I heard from Andrew that LeManic said, the other attorney would stand up and say, Your Honor, I object. That's a hearsay statement. That should not be, you know, put in evidence. The judge would then strike that statement from the record. But if the judge in that moment did not strike, the objection is filed. And when you file your appeal, well, I filed for an objection. This statement was said, and it's very likely that this is the reason why LeManic was found liable. Yeah. All right, almost done for the day. Time is getting short. Burden of proof. The burden of proof begins with the person making the claim. So the initial burden to prove their claim starts with the plaintiff. They're supposed to provide enough evidence to potentially show liability. Well, the burden will then shift to the defendant. Because then the defendant has the burden to prove their defense. And if the defendant is able to produce enough evidence to produce their evidence, then the burden shifts back to the plaintiff again. The burden shifts back and forth as both sides make their claim, make their defense, makes a counterclaim, makes a defense, and so forth. And it will continue until you feel you presented enough to win when you rest your case. Now, here's the thing, though. As far as a civil case goes, the burden is low. The technical phrase is by a preponderance of the evidence. So if I was to ask you on the next quiz, what is the burden of proof for the plaintiff in a civil claim? The response is preponderance of the evidence. What does that mean in simple English? the jury believes that it happened more likely than not. If you're suing someone, you don't have to absolutely prove it. But your claim has to be reasonable, possible. So, did the mechanic actually negligently install the brake line? We don't know. We weren't there. But is it logical that the moment you pick your car up and you can't get the working brakes, and you just had said brakes worked on, that it was a result of negligence? Yeah. Because brakes generally don't fail right after they're worked on, unless it was not done right. So to make it cleaner, you don't have to prove that they were installed wrong. You just have to produce enough that the jury would say, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Logical. Preponderance of the evidence. Semper necessitatis probani incumbent I qui agit. This is also something you need to remember. Not the Latin. Don't write the Latin down. Don't write the Latin down. I'm just being a jerk. The necessity, this comes out of Roman law. The necessity of proof lies with the person making the claim. The necessity of proof lies with the person making the claim. So just make sure you get it in properly. The burden shifts. Plaintiff to defendant to plaintiff to defendant to plaintiff, until defendant says, I produced enough, I rest my case. And then plaintiff says, I produced enough, I rest my case. And then it goes to the jury. Now, FYI, in a criminal case, what's the burden of proof? This is a criminal case. What's the burden of proof? What level of evidence does the jury need to provide to convict the defendant?
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Preponderance of the evidence is more likely than not. Could have happened. But to be found guilty in a criminal case, the government essentially must prove it absolutely. Questions? All right. When we come back, we're going to deal with some in-trial motions that could derail either party, and then we're going to go through the appellate process. I'm going to warn you, after we get through that, that's when I'm going to assign the first round of cases. So you can plan on over the weekend where it says homework number one, that's what you're going to be working on. So in the interim, if you want to open that up on my website and read through, familiarize yourself with the cases, that might not be a bad idea. And of course, get the book if you haven't done so. And if you got the book, read chapters 1, 2, and 3.
So assignment 1 is basically due next Monday.
Yes. Yes. Sounds good. He said it, not me. Andrew just gave you all homework.
Thank you. In the homework, we sent it in Blackboard, right?
No.
It's on your website.
It's on my website, problematic.com.
Thank you.
Yep.
Can we turn it in through there?
No. You're going to need to print it out. You're going to need to write out your brief, and you're going to need to bring your brief to class.
Okay.